Hi, this is Tony Baxter, and it's great to be a part today of the Skull Rock Podcast.
Skull Rock Podcast, talking all things Disney, with your hosts, Aljon Goh and Dave Bossert.
Welcome back to Skull Rock Podcast, and Happy New Year. Every week, Dave Bossert and myself, we talk all things Disney and pop culture with never-before-heard stories, behind-the-scenes moments from some of your favorite Disney films, theme park attractions, performances, books, music, and much more. Once again, Aljon Goh, I am your co-host, musician, long-time Disney, Marvel, and Star Wars fan, pop culturist. You can email me, Aljon, A-L-J-O-N, at skullrockpodcast.com, and you can email Dave, our wonderful co-host, artist, filmmaker, author, and all around good fellow at Dave at SkullRockPodcast.com. Now, before we get into things, once again, I wish everybody a happy, happy new year. Hope your holidays went swimmingly. Hope you're safe. And once again, thank you for everyone following our show and downloading, streaming the show on every podcast platform, leaving us those reviews, five-star reviews, hopefully. We absolutely love it, and we also appreciate the fact that once again, being one of the top 20 podcasts to follow from Disney podcasters last year, going to continue on that momentum this year. Next week, we'll be back with more great new content from Dave and myself, as Dave is on the road. He is visiting. He is having a good time, and I am here holding down the fort, and today, we have an awesome interview. We're back with George Scribner. And in talking with George Scribner, this is a revisit of a classic, one of our early shows that we had for Skull Rock Podcast. And we talk about Prince and the Pauper that he directed, as well as his work with Hanna-Barbera and Oliver and Company. Just a bunch of really cool things. So be listening for that later on this show. But I also have to talk about something that had happened recently, remembering Disney legend Betty White. And remembering Disney legend Betty White, the iconic star of the Golden Girls, passed away on Friday, December 31st of 2021, just a few days shy of her 100th birthday. And the film and television actress was named a Disney legend in 2009. It was an amazing sight to see. And we have here a clip that I'm going to play in just a little bit when Bob Iger presented the award to Betty White. And Tom Bertrand was hosting at the time of the D23 Expo back in 2009. Pretty cool stuff. But Bob Iger, executive chairman of the board of the Walt Disney Company, whose, by the way, last day was December 31st, New Year's Eve. He says, quote, "Rest in peace, Betty White, our golden girl, our friend and neighbor. Your wit, your charm, your warmth, and your smile will always be with us." Now, while she was inducted as a Disney legend in 2009, White exhibited her sharp wit when she joked, quote, "I want to put the rest of the humor that somebody started that I used to babysit for Walt when he was a little boy. I didn't." That was a really cool quote. You'll hear that in just a little bit. And we have a selection here from the Walt Disney Company's press release regarding Betty White's passing. From the moment White appeared on television in 1950, audiences and critics fell in love with her. From her hilarious portrayal of the snide happy homemaker Sue Ann Nevins on the Mary Tyler Moore Show, and her charming performance as Rose Nyland, the charmingly daft spirit played on the Touchstone television series The Golden Girls, to her scene-stealing role as Grandma Annie in Touchstone Pictures' The Proposal, White quickly cemented her place as one of the most popular and beloved American actresses of all time. The six-time Emmy Award-winning actress was born Betty Marion White on January 17, 1922 in Oak Park, Illinois, and raised in Southern California. After hosting a local television show, White formed her own production company in the early 1950s with producer Don Federson and writer George Tibbles. The pioneer of television, White was one of the first women to have control in both in front and behind the camera, and is recognized as the first woman to produce a sitcom. White's partnership with Federson and Tibbles led to her debut comedy series, Life with Elizabeth, for which she won her first Emmy in 1952. White then became a mainstay on variety and game shows and was in much demand in regular host with Jack Parr, Merv Griffin, and Johnny Carson. White had appeared on the Mary Tyler Moore Show in its fourth season and her star turn as the memorable Sue Ann Nevins resulted in two Emmy Award wins for Best Supporting Actress, first in 1974 through 75, then in 1975 to 76. Equally, if not more beloved, with her spirited performance as Rose Nyland from the critically acclaimed breakout hit The Golden Girls from 1985 to 1992, which was nominated seven times for an Emmy, winning once in 1985. The series also starred Bea Arthur, Estelle Getty, and Rue McClanahan, who with White were inducted as Disney Legends in 2009. After Golden Girls, White appeared in a spin-off series, The Golden Palace, which won an Emmy for her work on The John Larroquette Show, received an Emmy nomination for Suddenly Susan, and continued to appear on television shows such as Ally McBeal, That 70s Show, The Practice, Boston Legal, The Bold and the Beautiful, Ugly Betty, Hot in Cleveland, and Young and Hungry. White also appeared as herself in the animated series Family Guy and The Simpsons. For Disney, she performed A Conversation with Betty White, taped at the Disney MGM Studios theme park, of course now Disney Hollywood Studios, starred in the series Empty Nest as Rose Nyland, which also appeared in Maybe This Time, and she supplied the voice of Round in Disney's Whispers and Elephant Tale. She played Mrs. Klein in a Touchstone Pictures film Bringing Down the House opposite Disney legend Steve Martin, and she gave a scene-stealing performance as a grandma in The Proposal in 2019. She joined the voice cast of the Disney Pixar store in the Disney Pixar film Toy Story 4 as Bitey White, a toy tiger named in her honor, later reprising her in a role for an episode of the Disney Plus original series Forky Asks a Question. White is the author or co-author of several books, and in 2006 was honored by the City of Los Angeles as the ambassador to the animals for her lifelong work for animal welfare. Once again, just an amazing, amazing woman and talent and Disney legend, Betty White. I can't tell you how many times I've seen you gracing the screen, and you're absolutely amazing. You will be incredibly missed. What an amazing, legendary performer Betty White was, and I will absolutely remember her making us all laugh. And that is just one amazing career. So Betty, you will be missed. Rest in peace. And here is a segment of her getting inducted in 2009 at the D23 Expo as a Disney legend.
For any time, a true television and film legend, now a Disney legend. I've been stalking her for 2 days now. Betty White.
Seeing the number of legends up there and the company that you're being included into is just mind-boggling. I cannot tell you how thrilled and honored and excited I am. And the nicest part of it is that, first of all, I want to put to rest the rumor that somebody started that I used to babysit for Walt when he was a little boy. Doll came out. I was about that old, whatever that is. And I was so excited I needed that Mickey Mouse doll. And my parents, bless their hearts, bought him for me. And he still stands on my desk at home. And that was a lot of years ago. I not only got to work for Disney that several many years ago, and then I did the Marie Osmond series with Marie for Disney, and Bringing Down the House with Steve Martin. Yes. And I'm still working for Disney. They haven't caught on to me yet.
Skull Rock Podcast. Interview time.
You look just like I thought you were.
Wait. Just a moment.
Now, who are you?
And who is your tailor?
The name's Mickey. Mickey Mouse. Your Royal Highness. I mean,
The bigger boy. Well, Mickey, I must thank you for saving my life.
Saving your life?
I was about to die of boredom when you interrupted my lesson. Do you know what it's like to be the prince?
Oh, boy, it must be fun.
A moment to myself. Breakfast at 7.
Breakfast.
Lessons till lunch.
One.
Fencing till tea time. And every night, banquet after feast after banquet.
Huh? Wow.
And then 9 o'clock, bedtime.
Very fine.
Oh, how I envy your freedom.
Well,
games all day long, no studying dreary old books, staying up late as you like, eating junk food. Oh, if I could take your place for just one day. Yes, what a grand idea. Don't you see? It'd be perfect. I'll take your place with your friends in the streets of London, and you shall be the prince.
The prince? I can't be the prince. How do I act? What do I say?
You needn't worry, lad. To govern, you need to say only one of two things. That's a splendid idea. I'm glad I thought of it. And guards, seize it.
But your father, the king.
I'll be back in the wink of an eye. And if there's any trouble, all men know me by this.
Skull Rock Podcast. Interview time.
Well, Al John, we've got, I think, a fantastic guest today. He's a longtime friend of mine. He was a colleague of mine at the Disney Studios. I worked with him in Walt Disney Animation Studios and at Imagineering. The great George Scribner, who's not only an artist, but a director, a producer, a creative director. I mean, he runs the gamut. He's multi-talented. And I wanted to have him on our show because today, Monday, November 16th, is the 30th anniversary of Prince and the Pauper, which starred Mickey, Donald, and Goofy. And George directed that.
I love good it. Memory, Dave.
I know. Isn't that great?
Yeah, that's George. Great. Yeah, I completely forgot about it. Very cool, Dave.
You know, and I have to tell you, I got to tell you, George, I watched Prince and the Pauper a couple of weeks ago on Disney Plus, and I just like brought back a flood of memories.
You know, I'm really proud of this little piece, Dave. This had a great crew. Tom Enriquez was the art director. Don Yippies helped Enriquez and came up with a lot of great designs. We had Vance Gary as our principal story guy. Kirk Wise was between pictures and boarded the last sequence, nailed it on the first pass. Man, we were just, I was really, really lucky to have such a great crew. They made this little show.
You know, and it's a beautiful, I call it a featurette because it's what, 20 minutes long.
Yeah, it's about 20, 22 minutes. Yeah.
Yeah. And to me, it's beautifully animated. It also, there's a bit of, I think, a historic marker here because if I'm not mistaken, I think it was one of the last pieces of animation that was done as cell animation.
Yeah,
right.
In fact, I have some cells here right next to me, actually.
Oh, wow.
Actual setups with the backgrounds.
Yeah.
You're right, Dave.
Yeah, and because what people need to know is that Prince and the Pauper was in production while we were finishing Little Mermaid. Am I right on that? It was sort of at the tail end. It went into production at the tail end of Little Mermaid.
Yeah, sort of at the tail end. You're right. It really was set up to accompany Rescuers Down Under. So
yeah,
they would both be released as a sort of a double featurette, kind of a special event kind of deal with a small interstitial in the middle of it. So we were really more running parallel to that film, Rescuers Down Under.
Right, and Rescuers Down Under was the first animated feature from Walt Disney Animation Studios that used the CAP system, the computer animation production system, that allowed for all the drawings that the animators were doing and the backgrounds to be scanned into a computer system and then digitally inked and painted. So it was that transition period, and the systems, the computer systems themselves at that point were, primitive in comparison to what we have today.
We did a little bit on Oliver and Company with the trike, some of the vehicles. Then Mermaid did the vessels and some of the other just objects that were, I mean, you would know this.
Yeah, but that was computer animation. I'm talking about the digital ink and paint side.
Oh, you're right. The actual post. Yeah, the post system. You're right.
Correct. Yeah, and so while Rescuers Down Under, which was the first animated feature to use the computer animation production system for a digital ink and paint, the Prince and the Pauper, because it was a featurette, was essentially done still with the cell traditional cell method of hand painting the cells.
You know, and if I'm not mistaken, Dave, the reason for that was just resources.
Exactly. And the computer system couldn't handle all of that work. In fact, early on, you would have to tell the tech guys what scenes that were going to be worked on the next day. And overnight, they were loading exabyte tapes into a carousel that would read, you know, that data onto the computer. So, I mean, it was really unbelievable to me. But George, before we really start talking about Prince and the Pauper, I want to ask you, like, you started out going to college for film at Emerson in Boston.
Right.
And you graduated and you made your way out to Los Angeles because you wanted to become an animator. How did you get involved in animation? Because you didn't start at Disney right away. Would you tell us?
No, I graduated in film from Emerson College, went back to Panama, which is where I was born and raised, and worked in a film production house. We were doing spots, commercials. I was the editor. And I was looking for a way to come back to the States. It's sort of a long story, but I was from Panama, raised there, but had gone to school in the States and was looking for something else to do. I had directed theater. I had acted. I'd worked in film. I could draw. And while I was working at this production house in Panama, I read an article in Filmmakers Newsletter. I really don't even know if this exists anymore. That Disney was looking for animators, young people who wanted to be trained by the in-house, I guess at that time it was Eric Larson, because the group of animators that had come up with Walt, were that generation was retiring. So I was like, wow, this just felt like it was one of those moments of, hey man, that's actually this could be such a cool idea. I can draw, I had directed theater, I had acted, and really animation is acting on paper. I sent Disney a portfolio from Panama.
and you have dual citizenship, right?
Yeah, I have dual citizenship.
Yeah,
because I was born in Panama City, not the portion of the Canal Zone. But yes, I have dual citizenship. So I sent Disney a portfolio. I got some literature from them. This is what we're looking for: characters in motion, gesture. You know, the feeling that these characters are acting, performing. I sent them a portfolio. They sent me a nice letter back about 3 months later. Don't ever call us. If you call us again, we're going to call security. Please leave us alone.
they gave you the polite thanks, but no thanks, right?
You know, actually, it was a very generous response. Yeah. We really appreciate the effort you put into it because I put a lot of work into that portfolio. Sure. But what we're looking for is this. And they sent samples of loose human figures and in motion sports, you know, with a lot of gesture, with a lot of action to them. And at that point I decided I'll move to Los Angeles. And about 6 months later, I came to LA. I'm going to pursue this as a career and just see where it goes.
So what was your first job?
I started as a cell painter for Hanna-Barbera.
Wow.
That's awesome.
That's when they were still doing cell painting.
Yeah, they were still painting
in Los Angeles, right?
Yeah, they were painting all the series out in various warehouses all over the San Fernando Valley. And I was taking an animation class at Hanna-Barbera. Barry Cook was there, a couple other people who ended up being at Disney. And somebody came through the building and goes, hey, we're looking for people to do cell painting. It's 3 months, 3 or 4 months. The pay is good. It's union. And I was like, man, I'm going to do this. I'll be able to buy tires for my Volkswagen. This is awesome. I mean, at the time, relative to what I was making, it was halfway decent money. So I painted cells for 3 or 4 months. And the first real job in animation was working for Ralph Bakshi. He put out a call for animators and artists to do Lord of the Rings. He wanted.
I remember seeing Lord of the Rings in the theaters. Wow.
That was really the first one. And it was really basically tracing photographs. Go ahead.
So you did a lot of what was called rotoscoping, where he shot live action, and then the artists were using that as reference, but with Bakshi films, it was really, you were kind of tracing over the live action and stylizing it, right?
Pretty much.
Yeah.
And there was a whole group of us, we were all in our mid-20s, and it was an amazing opportunity. I've always taken the attitude, wow, you learn so much if you have a reasonably open mind, no matter what the circumstances, you're going to learn no matter what.
I have to tell you, a couple of weeks ago, we interviewed Joe Hale, the producer of Black Cauldron. And, you know, when I started at Disney, I started on Black Cauldron as an in-betweener in the effects department. Mm-hmm. And when they told me that they were going to hold on to me at the end of that picture, and they had done a big layoff, but they held on to me, they asked me if I'd paint cells to help get Black Cauldron finished. And I said, sure, absolutely. And it was the greatest education I ever had. Yeah. You know, and to this day, I look back and I say that whatever number of months I was painting cells taught me so much about the back end of the animation.
Correct.
Process.
And not only that, it taught you how to be disciplined, mm-hmm. how to allot your time and to think, you know, this is really important. You've got to get X number of however you want to measure that metric, that needs to be executed. I learned a lot from working in Saturday morning. We'll get to that. But I worked at Hanna-Barbera as well as an animator, and you learn to be very disciplined with your time, that half of being an artist. Anyway, painting cells was awesome, Dave, because it was me, one other guy, and 50 women, and they fed us so well. We got fed. I still have a huge debt of thanks to all these women who were so sweet to me, and I forgot his other name, but man, they would bring in, you look so thin, here's the Tupperware. I love you, man. Anyway, I learned a lot. So that was my first real animation job. And then starting at Bakshi.
And by the way, when you were painting cells, do you remember what shows you were painting cells for?
Yeah, Flintstones, Jane and Jana. Does that ring a bell? Jane?
Yeah, the Super Jana? Friends. You were doing Super Friends.
Elgin?
Yeah, you were Zan and Jana from the Super Friends for Hanna-Barbera.
Yeah, correct. Yeah. Scooby. I mean, it was a tremendous learning experience. I learned it affects my painting now. I learned to use a large brush on the back end of cells, and I got very good at it. I had great teachers around me.
And being able to puddle the paint on in sort of...
It was a real art to it.
Yeah,
it wouldn't crack. It wasn't too thin. I learned from every experience I've ever had. I've been very lucky.
Wow.
That's amazing.
And then from painting cells, you went on to animating. How did you get into animating from cell painting?
Like I said, Bakshi put an ad out in Variety. I think my wife saw it first, that he was looking for artists. He couldn't find people who were willing to work for him. So he reached out to the younger artistic community. You know,
why was that, George?
I don't know, Dave. I just don't know.
Ralph was from Brooklyn, New York, and had a rather volatile personality, wouldn't you say?
I would say so. Colorful, vibrant. Wow. What an opportunity. He puts a set out, I turned in a portfolio, and I got hired. So that was like March of 1978. I remember the day.
You know, I remember from back in those days, a story that floated around that Ralph got into fisticuffs with one of his producers in the parking lot of the studio.
I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
He was
really a larger than life character. And you know what? God bless him, because
very bombastic individual.
Yeah. You know what? But he gave him all these kids. I mean, it was in his interest as well, but he gave us all a fantastic opportunity. So I worked there for about a year, year and a half. Went from Lord of the Rings to...
Heavy metal, right?
No, heavy metal I did on the side as a freelance job while I was working Hanna-Barbera as an animator. So that's later. At Bakshi's, he did a couple features in a row.
Right.
That one. Then he did American Pop,
right.
Yeah, American Pop. Yeah. And by that time, I had an opportunity to work at Chuck Jones Studio after that.
Oh, wow.
Cleanup guy. That was Craig.
And Chuck was in charge, obviously.
He was in charge. Very small unit. It was himself, a very small administrative staff, a woman named Retta Davidson,
who headed the cleanup.
Myself, Terry Lennon, and another guy named Bob. I forgot his last name. There's just three of us. And we would clean up work that was being done by these animators would work with Chuck in the 30s and 40s at Termite Terrace. So you'd flip through their work, and it's not like I maybe completely understood what was going on, but you start to absorb. You're looking at charts and you're looking at how drawings are moving and the spacing, and you're checking the chart against the spacing of it, and you're going, I think you absorb it. It was a really, I was there like 6-7 months. I loved
it. You learn while you're doing.
You learn while you're doing.
Yeah.
It's really a great experience.
And how did that lead to Disney? And what was your first job at Disney?
Well, before I went to Disney, by the way, all this time I kept submitting portfolios to Disney. So I submitted over the course of a couple of years, but for completely different stacks of portfolios. And what I did was I just started concentrating on the figure. I would draw and draw and draw. And so,
and that was typical, by the way, of a lot of our colleagues. If they didn't come through Cal Arts, it was a matter of submitting a portfolio to the studio. And they were typically gracious about giving some feedback, weren't they?
They were very, I had several meetings with the person who was hiring. His name was Don Duckwall, and he would point stuff out. He would actually show me drawings. He goes, we're looking for material like this. Try and aim in this direction. Loosen your work up. He was very forthcoming and very generous.
Very nice.
So I ended up in Hanna-Barbera, worked there for a couple of years. There was a feature unit. I worked on Heidi's Song as an animator. That was my first full break as an animator. I mentored under an animator named Hal Ambrough.
Yeah, Hal Ambrough. He had worked at Disney years ago.
He worked at Disney years ago. And at the same time, I was picking up work from the Warner's animator who lived up in the Hollywood Hills. I'll think of his name. I'll bring it up later. But he was very generous. I would go to his house, pick up scenes from him, and he would then roll through the scenes. I animated in my closet. We didn't have any other room in my apartment. And I did all 3 or 4 scenes. And these people were all real generous to me. And I owe them, a huge debt of thanks.
Don't you think, though, in general, that artists are pretty forthcoming with
helping people out? Yeah, I think so. By nature, I would say they are.
Because you always want to show somebody how you did something, I mean, there's a certain amount of fun in that.
I would agree with you, Dave. By and large, the community, how do I put this? Let me tell a small story. When I moved out here from Panama, I met up with people who I'd majored and done film with in Boston. And I ended up working on 3 or 4 shows, live action shows. This is a Grip, Best Boy, and Carrying Cables, lighting stands, stuff like that. It was a very different tone to that business than the animation business. Mm-hmm. It was just I'm not sure how to put it, just more amoral. This was all very low budget films.
And it was more nomadic too, right? I mean, it was sort of like once you had a job on a picture like that, you were already looking for your next gig because you knew when it was going to end,
It had a very different tone and feel, to your point, Dave, of most people's generosity and willingness to give, which I loved about animation when I finally got into it.
And when did you get that job at Disney? What were they hiring you on to?
Black Cauldron. Submitting portfolios, and I finally got hired. I got a call from Don Hahn. This is after 3 or 4 nights.
So you were hired by Don Hahn as well. So was I.
As a character animator, yeah. We were both.
That's awesome.
It was very cool. I mean, it was a thrill of a life.
When you started working there, what character were you working on? Whose unit were you in?
I was under Andreas Deja, and because I'm a strong draftsman, I was actually given scenes of Taran, the boy, close-ups. My first scene was a close-up. Peers around the corner, and it was a test. It was a 2-week trial piece of animation under Rick Rich, the director. And after that time, it was approved. And I would bring the scene to Andreas for notes on drawing, notes on timing, notes on animation. He was very gracious and very helpful.
Still is. He's really one of the more generous artists that we've worked with, I think.
You know, I think back to your point, Dave, most, if you are reasonably open-minded, you're not challenging an artist, you're not being difficult with them, they're more than willing to pass on what they've learned. That's certainly been my experience.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And I think it's all about just asking for the help, you know.
And being gracious about it and being willing to go, you know what, I don't have the answer to this. I need help. I still do it with my paintings. I send paintings of mine to senior illustrators for notes. You're always going to get better. You're always going to be in a learning mode.
I'll have my notes for you later this afternoon.
Yeah, thanks, Dave. And by the way, I'll be sure to look at them. Oh, whoops. How'd that end up in the garbage? Oh, here's Dave's note.
Well, Black Cauldron was an interesting picture for us to begin our careers at Disney on, I think, because for me, I kind of felt like it was probably my first and last animated feature is sort of how I looked at it.
Me too.
I don't know about you. And the
Dave, we talked about this at lunch the other day. Yeah. I was convinced, you know what, maybe I'll be here a couple of years, 2 or 3 years. You know, I was used to looking for work midstream, like, okay, what's out a year from now? What's out 9 months from now? Oh, yeah, I was convinced it wasn't going to last.
Yeah, it was. I think it was one of those things where it was interesting because to me, I think that picture is underrated, you know, first of all. And second, it really was a transition from you know, the old guard to the new guard. And and it really got lost in the shuffle because of that.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
What do you have any fond memories from that picture? Anything come to mind right away?
One Christmas, we decorated our hall. Do you remember the halls at the main animation building, G Wing, F Wing, D?
Sure.
We were in G at the very end of the hall. We spent months because we weren't getting any scenes. It was just this long pause.
Yeah.
Getting scenes. We decorated a Yeti at the end of the hall. It was magnificent. This huge, enormous Yeti that framed the doors. I learned a lot, but I also had a lot of fun. I think they go hand in hand. You've got to have a release. So it was great. I got great scenes. I was able to take scenes to Eric Larson for notes.
Yeah, Eric was still there and mentoring there. All of the young guys that were coming in.
He was there, Walt Stanfield.
Another very generous artist that was in the twilight of his career.
You know, like you, Dave, or I'm pretty sure you probably feel the same way. I mean, I've been really lucky to have such strong mentors going back to Retta at Chuck Jones.
Sure.
And Bob Taylor at Hanna-Barbera. Bob Taylor was really a very talented guy, a little undisciplined, but tremendous animator and storyboard artist. And, you know, you learn to spot the ones who have something to offer, and I'm going to find him. I'm going to ask him a million questions.
Yeah.
And search out those people.
When did you transition out of animating into story?
At the end of Black Cauldron, there was a story guy named Pete Young, you know.
I remember Pete.
Who was next to me in the other room. He was working on small projects. Nothing had been greenlit because the transition had occurred from Ron Miller to Jeffrey and Michael and Roy.
Yeah, and they didn't know what to do initially.
They didn't know
the animation department.
We were all sort of in pause, just sort of like, and I made it clear to Pete and Don Hahn I wanted to get into story. I directed theater. I thought a feeling for narrative, an understanding of it, a structure of it. Yeah. And I started befriending Pete, and he saw something in me. He gave me a huge opportunity to mentor under him in story. We hadn't started anything. So I basically moved into his office, and we shared one of the storyboard desks, the big ones.
Yeah, yeah.
Sat across from me.
A Kem Weber director's desk is what that was. Yeah, where you sat on either side of the desk facing your colleague.
Facing each other. So you could do like, you'd draw a sketch, you'd hold it up, you'd talk about business. And so I started under Pete.
Man, he was an incredible talent, Pete, and a funny guy, a really funny guy, you know.
He had the gift, and there's certain people who have it. Vance, Mike Gabriel, Roger Allers, with the minimum of line, with very little really expressed on the paper, convey so much. And Pete was beyond a doubt the strongest story person.
Yeah.
Can't say story in the larger narrative sense, but for the moment, finding in one sketch, as he once put it, we're looking at Vance's sketches, you could see an entire sequence. It generated so much enthusiasm, this one sketch, and people liked that.
Yeah, boy, he was, I didn't really get to know him. I had talked with him a couple of times just, you know, in passing, but I didn't really get to know him. But I distinctly remember Don Hahn coming into my office to tell me the day he passed away. It was just such a shock, you know.
He had a difficult time adapting to the change of administration. He had a relationship with Ron, or they had history together.
Yeah.
When these new guys came in, it was a different tone, a different rhythm to the work. And he was really kind of a delicate, like a little boy.
Yeah.
And he just couldn't, he started getting sick. The pressure was, it was a lot of pressure when we first kicked Oliver off the ground, started trying to find it. Roy was involved. He wanted to sit on a story meeting. And Pete then started just to come down with a series of illnesses. He would be out for a week. He told me once he pulled over on the freeway and threw up. It was, I tried to, that was not an easy burial. It was not easy.
Yeah, very, very sad. So you crossed over into story, and then when did you get your first directing opportunity? I think
it
Roy
came
was
out of the
wasn't
film Roy? Oliver. Pardon?
Yeah, wasn't Roy responsible? Roy Disney.
Roy was responsible for my being made a director. Yeah,
yeah, yeah.
But prior to that, Pete had, there was a Gong Show early on with Jeffrey and Michael. A number of projects were pitched, including Oliver, Mermaid, I think Rescuers. I think those three were approved. This must have been 90, 80.
It was probably 88, 89.
No, because that's when Oliver was released. The Gong Show that started all these was late 84 or spring of 85.
Yeah. You're right. Yeah.
Pete pitched the idea of the Oliver Twist story, Oliver, with animals in New York, and they bought it. Jeffrey had always wanted to do that story, and we started developing it. And it's sort of one thing led to the next.
Can you just tell the tell our audience what the Gong Show was?
The Gong Show was a meeting. Periodically, the sort of the powers, like Jeffrey, at that time, Jeffrey Katzenberg, Michael Eisner, the executives would gather top story people, directors, and you had an opportunity to pitch an idea.
And you had a set amount of time, and anybody could pitch. Anybody in the anime, it could have been a secretary or a security host, or
I believe so. I think it was probably pre-screened, you know, so that the meetings didn't get unwieldy.
Yeah.
My best recollection was it was really it was more the directors and story people, and maybe those ideas, maybe they were conveying ideas that had been given to them. You could do a sketch. I remember Mike Gabriel holding up a very charming drawing of Pocahontas.
Yeah.
I remember Jeffrey going, that's it. He just pointed at it and goes, we're doing that.
Yeah. I think Mike's pitch was Walt Disney Pictures presents Pocahontas.
Yeah, correct.
That was it. He had a drawing.
Charming drawing. That was another guy. He could draw. He's really a remarkable artist. Oliver and Company, we started developing it.
You know, and by the way, when we talk about our friend Mike Gabriel, I mean, not only is he incredible talent and painter and, you know, production designer, I mean, you know, he really can wear multiple hats, art director, you name it. I've worked with him many times over the years. Fantastic, incredible artist, really nice guy. But he's another artist who it took him like 4 or 5 tries to get into the studio. From the story he told me, you know, of sending his portfolio in and then getting the very nice rejection note, but with some feedback, and he just kept at it. And by the way, never went to art school, self-taught. Yeah. And he's had a magnificent career at Disney.
He's he's just gifted. He really, when he came on to Oliver and Company, he just lifted the look, the spirit of sequences. I still owe him a huge debt of thanks for helping out with that picture. It was not a picture a lot of people wanted to work on. I'm trying to put this nicely. There was a feeling that people didn't understand it. They weren't clear why was I made a director? What experience did I have? I hadn't gone to Cal Arts.
Yeah. Well, but that's the Cal Arts mafia mentality.
I suppose so. the last thing I'd done, whatever. And Mike, he came in and boarded one early sequence in the picture, the song that Billy Joel sings, Why Should I Worry? And it was like, we put that in front of Jeffrey and Michael, and he was like, they weren't convinced it was a movie they wanted to pursue and continue. They weren't happy with the first iterations of it. And between Vance and Pete, and Mike, they really
pulled it out.
They changed the direction of the picture. Yeah.
Yeah. That's something else.
Yeah.
Wow. So I want to just ask you more about Prince and the Pauper now. Because you did Oliver first and then went on to Prince and the Pauper.
Correct.
Yeah. Yeah. And so Oliver and Company gets completed, gets released, and does reasonably well.
Reasonably well?
It did really well. Okay. I'm sorry.
Yeah. No, but let me clarify. At the time, it was the highest grossing animated film.
Yes.
It didn't compare at all to what followed it. I mean, Mermaid and Beauty and the Beast. In those terms, yeah. But it was,
I think it was in the beginning stages of what they now refer to as the Renaissance of animation. And it was really sort of an upbeat, fun movie. It had contemporary music. It was, stylistically had its own look, like most of the films do, But how was it going from that picture then on to a picture that had the classic characters, Mickey, Donald, and Goofy in Prince and the Pauper?
I was actually looking for another feature to go on to, and there really wasn't anything available. There were a number of pictures that had been approved, but there were a lot of other directors waiting for.
Yeah, there were other people attached to those.
There were other people attached to it and waiting for their slot and waiting for their opportunity, which is fair enough. And Peter Schneider said, look, I know this isn't something that it isn't. It's not a feature. It's not exactly what you're looking for. Just do me a favor. Just take care. Just build the story reels. We don't have to finish it.
Just the way
build
Peter
the story reels.
Peter always started out that way. He was
very clever.
He was so great about getting people to do what he wanted them to do and in such a nice way.
I mean, okay, fine. All right. I'd come off a movie with Billy Joel and Bette Midler and Barry Manilow. And I'm like, I really don't want to do Mickey. But you know what? I read the script that Charlie Fink had developed with two writers. I forget their names, but it was really a great script. And it had one moment in it, the death of the king in the presence of Mickey Mouse. And what occurred to me at the time, Dave, was, wow, can we pull this off? This would be great to try. Can a Shorts character sit by the side of a, even if it's a cartoon, but it's still, it was pretty heavy for a Shorts character to be in that kind of setting. And I loved the mood that struck me. And wow, can we pull this off? And I agree. All right.
Just the emotional,
one scene.
Pulling it's the emotion best. Out of that.
It had a lot more range to it than our traditional Shorts characters ordinarily, are asked to convey in a short. This was really a great challenge.
George, I love that scene. I just want to tell you how much I love that scene.
Thanks very much. It's the reason I did that short. Mm.
I get chills just thinking about it, after watching it. And just if you've experienced loss, it definitely hits home, because there's nothing worse than, experiencing loss, but even experiencing loss at a distance, right? We can't always be home when a loved one passes, or even a pet, when a pet passes. Sometimes you're far, far away. And when that scene happens, you know, I'm just getting chills. The shadows and the reflections, and then when the light finally extinguishes in the candle, and you're going, oh my gosh, I can't believe that his son is not actually there by his side, but then Mickey experiences that, is really emotional.
I'll explain everything. The king will understand.
My son.
Huh? Well, I'm not really the...
Come closer. Mm-hmm. My son, from the day you were born, I have tried to prepare you for this moment. I shall be gone soon, and you will be king. You must promise me that you will rule the land from your heart, justly and wisely.
I promise.
Very good. So good.
No, I appreciate that. I mean, it sounds silly that would be the one thing that would spark an interest in this script, but it did it. It was like, if we can pull this off and give this much depth to a Schwartz character, I love this challenge. Let's give this a try. Let's try. By the way, that scene mechanically, Dave, this is all traditional down-shooter cameras and stuff. It never came in right. It just never came in right. The camera would lock up, or it wouldn't ease in and ease out enough. You know, it drifts on the diagonal up to the. I had to go beg the Ink and Paint and the. What was the group that did camera? The final group that did camera planning.
The final checkers. Or
final check. Scene I got down on my knees.
Yeah, scene planning and final check. Yeah.
It was a woman named Anna Marie Costa. Please, I love you. Please reshoot this scene, please, for me.
That was scene planning. Scene planning.
Yeah, and she did it for me.
Yeah.
It came out good. Anyway.
One thing that struck me about the film also was how beautifully dimensional all of those characters are drawn. I mean, you could really see that new crop of animators that had come in, you know, in a few years earlier, really starting to get, I think, hit their stride almost, you know?
There was some great animators.
Some Dan beautiful, Chu beautiful animated. Mickey animation. I don't know, did Mark Han work on that? It was Andreas, wasn't it?
Andreas did a few scenes, Dan Juke did, and about a third of the picture was actually done by Dale Bear's company.
That's
Dale
right.
Dale Bear himself animated some really, some key scenes. They were priceless. I never had a note on his animation.
Dale's what an incredibly nice guy, and also an incredible animation talent. You know,
I mean, they did about a third of the picture, so we just didn't have the resources. We didn't have the animators or space, and we would go over there and look at dailies and look at animation and review stuff. And they did.
We got to get Dale Bear on the show at some.
Yeah,
point.
Yeah, you do, Dave. He's got great stories. He's been around. He's got a lot of history, a lot of provenance. He would be great for you.
I hope he has internet at his ranch.
We can always phone him. We'll get him over the phone.
I know, really.
No, Dave, smoke signals. Do you want to? Hold on, we're getting an answer. Give us a day. Wait. Hold on.
So, George, the Prince of the Pauper was produced by Dan Rounds. And when I saw his name on the credits, I hadn't thought about him in years. I just was like, wow, Dan, I remember him. He was an incredibly nice guy. And I wondered what he ever went on to do.
You know, I think you and I talked about this. I think he ended up at ILM, and I've lost track of him. I would love to talk to him. He marveled at what we were doing because he was new to animation, not necessarily the process globally, but how we did it.
Yeah.
And we, our biggest, probably our biggest challenge with that feature was trying to condense all that story into 20 minutes.
Sure.
That was a real narrative trick.
And always the, I mean, that's always the tough thing to do in animation is to boil it down to those moments, you know, that really tell the story arc.
Yeah. In 20 minutes.
Yeah. I
mean, Dan had an expression for the movie. He had all these expressions that an animator named Leon Chusin wrote down. One of them is, I still have them somewhere, Little Freight Train. He called Prince in the Park, Little Freight Train. It had to move. It had to just move so quickly to get through so much story. But I'm really, really proud of that film. We used watercolor backgrounds or gouache to simulate that look from the 30s. The Brave Little Taylor was the model.
Right.
Not only Mickey's model, because that's the design we chose, that look from that period. But the, as you were saying earlier, the transparency of the backgrounds, the look and the painting of the backgrounds.
Do you remember who headed up backgrounds?
Yeah, Kathy Altieri.
That's right. Yeah. Altieri. Wow.
She ended up at DreamWorks. I don't know if she's still there.
Name I hadn't heard in a long time.
She was terrific. She was just great to work with. That's one thing about working at Disney. You really want to work with people who are just agreeable, who are positive, who are going to be additive to a project. We've both met people, Dave, who, you know, they just stand in your way, either without saying something or just they stand in your way. You simply can't. It's hard enough getting a picture off the ground without having to deal with people who aren't interested in moving it forward.
Sure, sure. You had, I think on that picture, some really great story artists. And just to drop a few names, Roger Allers worked on the story. Went on to co-direct The Lion King. And then Kirk Wise and Gary Trousdale both worked in the story department. And they went on to obviously direct Beauty and the Beast and The Hunchback of Notre Dame and several other pictures. So, I mean, really incredible talent in the story department, wouldn't you say?
We were really lucky to have access to some of these story people. Rebecca Reese worked on it. Robert Lentz worked on it.
Yeah, Robert Lentz. Yeah.
Really. Bernie
Mattinson. Bernie Mattinson, by the way, who still works at the Disney Studios and is, I think he's the longest serving employee of the Walt Disney Company ever. He's been with the company now, I think, 64 or 65 years. Is that correct?
You know what, Jamie?
Something like that.
Actually, he lives down the street from me.
Yeah, wow.
He occasionally tries to run me over. I'm not quite sure what that means. Speed it up and be walking my dogs. And
you know, the other aspect of Prince and the Pauper that I think is interesting to talk about too is the voice talent, because you got to work with Wayne Alwyn, who really was the third person to do the voice of Mickey. I mean, Mickey was originally voiced by Walt Disney. And then Jimmy McDonald, who is in the sound department at the studio, took over the voicing of Mickey. And then Wayne Alwyn came in. And so Wayne did the voice of Mickey for Prince and the Pauper. You had Bill Farmer, who does Goofy and is still doing Goofy. He's incredible. And Tony Anselmo, who is a contemporary of ours, doing the voice of Donald Duck. You know, it was really kind of seamless to when you watch that picture. If you watch like Brave Little Taylor or some of the earlier shorts, there's the same sensibility. You know, I mean, yeah, I think there's probably
the
a little
voice,
bit
more, the voice talents.
Yeah, not only the voice talent, but also just artistically, there's Prince and the Pauper to me has a little bit more lushness because you had. You know, it's a featurette, so it's not just a 7-minute short. So you're able to do a little bit more in the way of complex layouts and backgrounds and things like that.
like I said, we use Brave Little Taylor, the pointer, for inspiration for the look of that. And like I said, it was very thin washes and watercolor washes, or even if we had to simulate it, but that was the that was the look. Let me tell you a real quick anecdote about Wayne and Mickey. The first concept for the voice for the prince would be to give him an English accent. So Mickey would retain his Mickey voice, but that the prince would have like a small boy's English accent. And we tried it. We spent like months on it. And Jeffrey, to his credit, made the final decision. You know, that's the charm of this. You have Mickey and Mickey. But Wayne pulled off both. He was a very capable actor. Had a lot of range to him. Having directed actors, you could ask him anything. Give him the dimensions of what the scene is and let him explore it. He was very inventive.
Yeah.
Well, you mentioned George directing the voice talent. When you're doing that scene where the dying king is there and Mickey is there, did you have the voice actors in the same studio cutting the voiceover? Was Wayne and Frank Welker there together? Were you in directing them?
No, unfortunately, we didn't have that luxury. Okay. Frank Welker worked a lot, and I was able to. I would read with the talent, and that would help them. So I would sit in the same room with them, and those are probably the most difficult takes to get out of Mickey because they had to be a whisper and still maintain the timbre, the pitch.
That's right.
There were really difficult lines to get out from him. We spent a lot of time on this.
Yeah, I can imagine. I mean,
honestly, it's a luxury to have an ensemble in, to do a voice recording. You know, most of the time you're just doing individuals.
You know? No, it is a luxury, and you're going to get material you'll never, ever imagine you'll arrive at.
When the talent would gather together, did they ever do, like you mentioned, a table read? Did they ever record those table reads out of curiosity?
We didn't do it on those pictures. I think that came later.
Okay.
In the later pictures, we didn't on Oliver and Prince.
It was just,
we had talent from all over the States. I mean, Billy was in New York, sure. Billy. You know, my close friend, Billy Joel. Billy Joel was in New York.
Of course.
Bette was out here. And Barry Manilow. It would have been impractical to get this group in the same room.
Well, I have to say, Oliver and Company, too, it's just so much fun. And you, with the contemporary music, and I'm such a Billy Joel fan myself. I feel that film just encapsulates and Dave, you know, you're from that area too. I mean, I've been to New York several times, but I just feel New York when I watch that film. It just feels special and it sounds great. I love the soundtrack.
Yeah. Up until the pandemic hit, Billy Joel was, did a series of concerts once a year at Madison Square Garden. You know, he lives out on Long Island, and you know, on Long Island, he's almost a king.
He's the king,
ubiquitous with the island. You know, and I have to say, when I watch that picture, it does bring back a lot of memories.
Yeah,
you know, quick note about Billy Joel. At one point, we ended up driving out to the end of Long Island and recording him in his studio. Not sure exactly.
Out in the Hamptons?
Uh-huh.
Or Sag Harbor, out in that area.
It was out in the Hamptons somewhere, a very small little studio that he wasn't able to come into the city, and we all drove out there with his mic. We had the right mic for him, and it was great fun. He was very generous. Speaking, Dave, we were talking about earlier about this. Man, he never made me feel like, who are you? You're in your mid-30s. What have you done? I'm Billy Joel. He was the most gracious, fun. He really got into it. I would give him lines of dialogue. And he'd go, yeah, I got it, man. I got it. Awesome. Okay, let's go. And I would read against him. I'd read Oliver's lines. Really a sweet, funny guy.
That's awesome. I've heard nothing but good things about him. And by the way, just as a side note, on Long Island, he used to, and I don't know if he still does this, but he used to, every once in a while, he would just show up at a bar and start playing.
Wow, that's cool.
Like he would just walk it. Well, you know, he'd go into some local bar on Long Island, sometimes with some musician friends or by himself, and he would just start playing, and nobody knew it was him until he started playing.
Oh, that's awesome!
I mean,
cool thing to do.
I always admire musicians when they do that kind of stuff. Al John, you know this. You're in Nashville.
Oh, yeah.
There's folks that just show up at places and they try out new material and whatnot.
Every day.
Just cold, right?
Yeah, every day of the week. I mean, you could be sitting in a bar somewhere and then all of a sudden Keith Urban just decides to show up, or Brad Paisley or Carrie Underwood, and they just jam with the house band, or they just pick up a guitar and they start playing. And that's the magic of being in those hometowns. And I can only imagine, you know, me being such a huge Billy Joel fan to just walk in. But I mean, George, what a great talent pool for Oliver and company. Just, I mean, once again, how did that, what was it decided early on to get these A-list musicians to be part of this production? Or was it, how did that come about?
No, the original intent was not that big. It wasn't like we started with this very small little charming story. And to his credit, it was Jeffrey Katzenberg who pushed, look, let's go for it. We have talent available to us. Bette Midler was doing a couple of films for the studio. He talked her into auditioning. When I say audition, I mean, it was a done deal for Georgette the Poodle. And Billy, of all things, I auditioned Billy from a car in Glendale in an industrial park, Dave, right outside the building, 1401. It was about 10 o'clock at night. I'm on a phone that's, can you see my hands? It was about this big. It was like holding up a wingtip. It's like holding up a wingtip, you know, like a wingtip shoe. Like, and Billy's on the other line. Our music director knew him and said, no, I can contact. So Billy, we sent Billy a couple pages. I read Oliver. I'm in a car, 10 o'clock at night. All right, you ready? Here we go. I'll give you Oliver's first line. I start to read. Billy starts to read. Like, you got the part from a car in Glendale at 10 o'clock at night.
You're perfect. If people really knew some of the things that have gone on behind their favorite movies and how things came about, they would just be astounded, you know, because those are, to me, the nuggets of gold on making these projects, you know. And by the way, just getting back to Prince and the Pauper, Prince and the Pauper released with the Rescuers Down Under, as the Rescuers Down Under was the 29th animated feature film from Walt Disney Animation Studios, and it released as a featurette ahead of that. And
it was a double bill, right?
Yeah, as a double bill. Mm-hmm. And how did you feel about the reception?
It was very positive.
Yeah.
It was very, very positive. We were just sort of on this arc. And every picture just got better than the one before it. And we were being acknowledged and recognized for the work that was being done.
Yeah, and animation was becoming cool again.
I think if Oliver had not done well, I'm not sure the division would have, I'm not sure they wouldn't have gotten rid of the division. But Roy aside, I think it would have fought for it. But there was a lot of effort to, we're done. The vault is worth the assets in the vault are worth an extraordinary amount. We don't need to carry all this labor. And I'd be in these meetings. I'd hear this guy named Jeff Rockless, and Jeffrey would get into this in front of us. And
the bean counters. You know.
Yeah, you know what? And from a business point of view, I get it. The last couple of features.
You know something, George, you mentioned early on when you were painting cells how important it was to sort of understand what you were doing and manage your time and get a certain amount of stuff done. And I have to, I almost said it then and I'm going to say it now. I mean, animation is an art form, but it's also a business.
It's a business.
You know, and you really have to kind of balance that in order to continue to create these masterpiece films. You know, they have to be done for a reasonable amount of money because, you know, I think there was a point there where some of these studios were spending $175 and $200 million to make, you know, an 87-minute animated film. And that is a huge gamble, you know? And so, you know, to me, it really harkens to, you know, the artists themselves being able to be responsible and manage their time and how they're creating the work that's going into these films.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Dave. And I would also say that I was lucky enough to have very, very good producers. Sorry about the phone. Kathleen Gavin, this woman who was a producer in Oliver and Company, she would very clearly say, all right, we have X number of resources left. You want 1, 2, 3, and 4. These are the things that you'd like in the picture. You have to decide what is more important to you and what are you willing to give up?
Yeah.
And that's a fair, absolutely a fair trade.
You know, and I think what's great about somebody like Kathleen Gavin as a producer was she didn't hide that from the talent. She put that on the table and said, okay, how do we want to get this done? You know,
by the way, Dave, you should get her on this.
Yeah. She was somebody who folded in the artists and didn't shield them from this stuff, but actually folded them into the conversation and made you have a stakeholder. You were one of the owners that had to make the decision.
You were part of the solution.
Yeah,
it wasn't dictated to you. How do you want to do this?
Correct. And I think in those situations, it forces the creative talent to be even more creative and inventive in figuring out, well, okay, we only have a certain amount of money. We only have a certain amount of time. How can we make it the best it possibly can be? And some really fantastic and inventive solutions come out of those situations.
The head of Imagineering, a guy named Marty Sklar, used to argue that the greatest thing that you can put in front of somebody was the blank page and very clearly describe what the box is. Here are the parameters of the project, because you're going to draw on creative resources that you never thought existed. It will force you to make, in the end, better decisions that you would have made if it had just been wide open. Oh, you have unlimited amounts of money. It was a great discipline. And to your earlier point,
is that your agent calling?
Yeah, you know what? This is really getting in my way. Are we done? I thought this was going to be like 10 minutes.
But anyway, no, it's right. Never 10 minutes with us on Skull Rock Podcast. I have to tell you,
have to post something at 12 o'clock. So that's the only thing I have to, I don't know what your out is, but.
No, we're going to wrap up shortly, but we did really want to, we talked a lot about Oliver and Company. We talked a lot about Prince and the Pauper. The 30th anniversary is Monday, November 16th. And I would encourage people, if you haven't watched Prince and the Pauper, if you've never seen it or you haven't seen it in a long time, you should really stream it on Disney Plus and give it a watch. It's a 22 minute show and it's just beautifully done. I really enjoy it. And for whatever reason, it has a bit of a holiday feel to me because of the snow and all of that in portions of it. So it is very timely. Aljon, you want to add anything to that?
I think it's great. And you're right. It does give all the feels. It's a great adaptation of a very classic story. And George, I think you crammed a lot in those 22 minutes because it feels very complete. It's just such a tight film. It feels complete. I feel good when I watch it. And when I watched it recently, once again, it just hits all the right notes for me. So thank you so much for a great film.
I have to give a small note to the writers who worked on it, because we did not really veer that far off from that first 30 pages that I read. It's a great example of good writers make an enormous difference. They're critical to a good film.
It's so good. And, you know, Donald is one of my favorite characters, and I think it's always great to see.
Thanks. I've directed him so many times. My motto with him is you cannot do enough damage to him. He just is the greatest character. Dave and I worked on, I don't know if we're going to get to this, at Epcot, we did a little Mexico project with Donald. He's just the greatest, most fun. Every personality goes out to the extremes. Every attribute, if he falls in love, he falls desperately in love.
I love it. I love it. Well, you know, and that's why I'm wearing the shirt today, because I know that you guys worked on that. I know that you guys worked on PhilharMagic, which I love so much. So we'll have to talk about it sometime when you come back. Because once again, Donald's my favorite, and I know that you bring him to life in such a great way. So thank you for all of that. And thank you for Prince and the Pauper. What a great film.
No, thanks.
Yeah, really terrific.
It was nice.
I think nice to mark the 30th anniversary. I think that's a significant anniversary, and it still holds up really well. Beautifully crafted. George, you, you know, again, you were an animator, a story artist, a director at Walt Disney Animation Studios. Then you moved over to Imagineering. You spent years working on all kinds of shows at Imagineering for the parks all over the world. And you also are an incredible painter. And I have to tell the audience this, that over the last couple of weeks, you've been posting a painting a day for sale, and a portion of the proceeds are going to charity. And every time I see one of your paintings on social media, I go, oh, I love that painting. I want to get that painting. And then I read the text and it's like sold, 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 sold,
of course,
sold. I'm like, holy crow. You know, I mean, come on, give us a
Did
chance.
You, see, you mean sold, comma, Dave?
No, they're sold to other people, but I mean, some beautiful paintings. Yes. I want to just touch briefly on the fact that you have been just a dedicated painter. You're doing some online painting classes, I understand. Aside from, you know, your teaching before this pandemic hit, you were doing group classes, painting classes, and just talk a little bit about that. And if anybody's interested in wanting to see what you've done on YouTube or online, where can they find some of those tutorials?
I'm starting to put those together on YouTube, and I will make that public at the moment. I'm just building it.
Okay. So
it would be a series of tutorials, but that's in the offing. In fact, I'm recording this afternoon. So I've got three or four of them now. I can send you a link if you want to forward it to your listeners.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we'll put it on the show notes for our podcast. That would be really great. I think people would be interested in seeing that. You're on social media. People can find you on Facebook and LinkedIn and see your fabulous paintings that you've been posting. Many of them, I have to tell you, I keep wanting to get one of the, he's done a number of paintings of the Sabret hot dog carts in New York City.
Love it.
And I've been trying to grab one of them, and every time I see one, it's sold already. You know, and that's how great these paintings are.
They are tremendous.
So, George, just keep that in mind if you're doing more Sabret hot dog cart paintings, that I would like one. You know, and I'm happy to pay for it.
At a friends and family discount. Sure, sure.
There you go. George, anything else you want to add? I mean, honestly, we could talk for hours, but we do have a show format here. And I did want to just give you the last word about your experiences with Walt Disney Animation Studios and Prince and the Pauper.
Thanks, Dave. No, we covered pretty much everything, and I appreciate the time. I appreciate the thanks for inviting me. It's an honor. I appreciate it. Well, you know, I made a point earlier about you, and I've brought this up in classes and other presentations. You know, there's a time in your life when you give back, and that is what I'm sort of in that mode now. There were people who helped me. I'm here because there were five or six people who were instrumental in my career and the work I do now. And part of this giving back to these 30 paintings that I'm doing, I'm donating half of that to the food banks.
Yeah.
There's a need. And, you know, I think all of us have a point in our lives when it's time to give back. And that time has now come for me.
That's great. What advice would you give to anybody who's listening that's interested in getting into animation or film? Like you did, what would you say to your 20-year-old self today? advice wise?
There's so much resources now online on YouTube that there are two or three really reputable first rate animation mentoring programs. I think Animation Mentor is one of them. I know there's others, and I would encourage people to to avail yourself. The Bancroft brothers, I think, do a series of teaching. Yep. There's so much available to you now that was not available to you and me when we started.
And there's so many different channels where people can create animation. You know, years ago, it was Saturday morning cartoons or the occasional feature film that only Disney was doing back in those days. Now you've got so many different studios. I mean, Netflix made an announcement that they're going to do 6 animated features a year. And you've got, all these other studios that are producing animation features. You've got gaming companies. You've got all these different streaming channels that are doing not only children's animated shows, but adult animated shows. Simpsons, Bob's Burgers, BoJack Horseman, all of these types of shows that are out there. So there's so many more avenues for animation talent to really pursue and get jobs in than there was when you and I first started out. When we started on Black Cauldron, George, when we started on Black Cauldron, that was the only feature film in production at the time.
No, I believe you, Dave. There was very little work. It was random.
Yeah, it's amazing. Anyway, George, I want to thank you. I don't want to take up any more of your time. We really appreciate you coming on the show. Dave. It was just fabulous to chat with you. I know we'll be having lunch again soon.
On you. You're going to pay, right? Good.
Gee, didn't I pay the last time? I paid the last time. Wait a second.
That's now a ritual. That's tradition. Tradition is very important.
He's trying to butter.
Nice. All right, George.
Nice to meet you, George. And just remember, Dave is buttering you up for those hot dog cart paintings. So
you have to do a lot more than that. I want to see some euros.
All right, George.
All right, Dave. Good to talk to you.
Thanks for being on the show. George.
Thanks good very much for being invited.
Thank you.
Take care, you guys.
Take care.
Take care. Bye-bye. All
right. Skull Rock Podcast. Your passport behind the scenes of Disney fantasy.
And with that, I hope you enjoyed a look back at one of our awesome classic interviews with director George Scribner as we talked about The Prince and the Pauper, and about Oliver and Company and the work with Hanna-Barbera. So cool. Hopefully we'll have George back on the show really soon and to talk about more of his work in animation, as it's always fun to kind of revisit those classics that we've grown up over the years to watch and see. It just is so much part of our lives, which is why we love this show. So thank you. Thank you so much for tuning in to our show every single week. As I said, Dave will be back next week, but we're always able to talk about pop culture, the latest and greatest when it comes to movies, films, animation, and theme parks. So cool. And I encourage everybody to, once again, leave us those reviews. Follow us on all our socials. We're on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. You can also email us, aljohn@skullrockpodcast.com, as well as dave@skullrockpodcast.com. Thank you so much for checking out our show. And as we say all the time, thank you, be well, be safe, and we'll see you on the next episode of Skull Rock Podcast. I'm Al John Goh, co-host of the Disney List Podcast, as heard on Sorcerer Radio, as well as Skull Rock Podcast, here with my wife, Kristen. Hello.
Hello.
You are an earmarked agent who books Disney travel and vacations for people all the time. Give our listeners a reason why they want to give you a call instead of just booking a trip by themselves.
Well, I can do all of the legwork for them. I have expertise. I've been to the Disney parks well over 100 times, so they've got that knowledge at their hand, as well as it saves them time and money.
Where can people get in touch with you so that they can book their next Disney cruise, Disney park trip, Adventures by Disney?
they can contact me at themeparksandcruises@gmail.com. I'm Kristen Hetzel, vacation planner, world traveler, Disney foodie, and theme park fan.
I'm Al John Goh. I'm the husband who's also Disney, Star Wars, and Marvel Comics fan. And together, we host a Disney List podcast.
Every week, you'll hear us list our favorite things about Disney theme parks, films, shows, travel, Marvel, and Star Wars in a top 10 list, rankings, and more.
That's an impressive list. Subscribe to the Disney List podcast on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, iHeartRadio, or your favorite podcast platform. You can even stream us on Sorcerer Radio at srsounds.com and check out our live shows on Facebook. The Disney List Podcast. Visit thedisneylist.com.